up killing a guy and serving time. Becky got to gloat to her friends how she'd put me away. Who was the prosecutor? John Babington. Jobs are scarce in Milford Falls to start with, but on top of that, being a convicted felon makes it nearly impossible to get hired. I've studied martial arts almost since I was in diapers, so I decided to put it to use and open my own martial arts studio to make a living. Could you have killed that guy intentionally if you needed to? He looked like he couldn't believe she doubted his ability. In the first second he came at me, I could have broken his neck. I could have killed him a dozen different ways if I had wanted to mess him up. No problem. But I wasn't looking to kill him or even hurt him. I was simply trying to leave. I was done with that drama queen, and I didn't want to get dragged back into a soap opera. But Babington was happy to fuck up my life as long as he could use my case to help him get elected. 32. As it just so happens, Angela said, I met John Babington today. It did not go well. He looked surprised and a little suspicious.
Really? What were you doing with Babington?
Angela pulled out the mugshots. She unfolded them and handed all four to Nate. I have a courier business. I delivered a package to these four men. They overpowered me, raped me, beat me nearly to death, then hung me by my neck from a beam and left me to die.
Yeah,
he said quietly.
I saw what's left of the bruises and abrasions around your neck from the rope. I wondered what that was about. I'm sorry you had to go through that.
He gave her a puzzled look.
But if they left you hanging there by your neck, how the hell did you get out of it?
Angela pulled her knife from her boot and held the blade up briefly, then slid it back down into its sheath. He looked a little surprised to see that besides the gun, she also had a knife. I gave the police their license plate number along with their names and descriptions. All four were arrested. John Babington dropped the charges and had them released. Nate made a face.
Why?
They're illegal aliens. This is a sanctuary state. Babington didn't want to be accused of being a racist for prosecuting illegal aliens or get in trouble with the politicians above him for violating that policy. It would be bad for his career. So, he dropped the charges. When I objected, he said I was a whore, and implied that I probably got what I deserved for enticing the men. The police had confiscated my knife when I was in the hospital. He threatened to prosecute me on concealed weapon charges, along with invented drug charges, if I made a fuss over it. He's a pompous prick. I knew better than to cross him. Nate let out a sigh.
That sounds like Babington. I'm glad you were smart enough not to test him. He would have carried out the threat. Believe me. I know.
He folded his arms.
So, what do you want from me?
Those four men overpowered me in an instant. I had this knife on me, but they grabbed my wrists before I could even try to get to it. I tried as hard as I could to get out of their grip, but I couldn't. They were a lot stronger than me. I was at their mercy, and they had none. I was helpless. I don't like being helpless. His expression reflected his understanding as she went on. I know that people who don't have a weapon, but who know what they're doing, can get out of it when men grab them and even turn the tables on them. I know that there are people who know how to put down the threat, even though the men are stronger. But I didn't know how to do it. I spent hours being abused and beaten by these men. You can't imagine the degrading things they did to me, or how they hurt me. I nearly died. I thought for sure that I was going to die hanging there.
Thank God you survived. At least it's over.
Angela shook her head. I know them. These aren't regular bad guys. There's something more. They would know by now that I escaped the death they had planned for me, and now that they're out of jail, they will come after me to finish what they started.
Besides that, it's also a matter of their masculinity, their imagined superiority. A woman bested them. They can't have that. But it's not just those four. I tend bar, and that can be risky at times. I'm a woman, and I'm not as strong as most men. On top of that, for some reason, I seem to attract bad guys. I want to know how to stop killers like these four, or any man, for that matter, who intends me harm. Can you teach me that? Nate shrugged.
Sure. I'm strongly in favor of women knowing how to protect themselves, but it takes...
You don't understand. I don't have a lifetime to devote myself to learning some kind of higher way of life. I don't want a hobby or inner peace. I don't want to learn forms and ritual moves that have fancy names. I'm not a bored housewife. I'm not a gullible girl looking for the meaning of life. I don't have time for any of that crap. I'm not interested in learning to protect myself the way you teach women to protect themselves. This isn't about empowerment. I don't want to learn martial arts and get colored belts. I want you to teach me down and dirty street fighting. I want you to teach me how to hurt people who need hurting. Those four men are out there somewhere. I want you to teach me how to put them down when they come after me. I don't want you to teach me how to simply get out of their grip so I can run away. Nate cocked his head.
But there are a number of steps.
And I also don't want to go to classes with other women. I'm not looking to compete in stages or any of that stuff. I'm only interested in one thing. I want you to teach me how to fucking kill them. I know how to do it with a gun or a knife, and if I can, I will. But I need to know how to do the same thing if I can't get to a weapon in time. I don't want to be defenseless if all I have are my bare hands. That's what I need you to teach me. He studied her eyes for a moment as he considered.
You're talking about something very different than my standard self-defense training.
Like I said, I don't need a hobby.
You're talking about some serious game-ending moves.
Exactly.
I don't ordinarily teach those to idiots like Malcolm. You're talking about things that can break bones or even kill. You only use deadly force in life-and-death situations when it's you or them, the same as with a gun.
I understand. He looked dead serious as he considered her for a few moments longer.
You would have to come in for a few hours every day for a while. That would give you a good variety of effective moves, the kind of things you're talking about. You can learn those moves fairly easily, actually, if that's all you're interested in learning. You're not interested in advancing through martial arts, so you can do without most of the rest of it. You won't understand the totality of it, but you will know how to seriously hurt people.
As long as I'm able to put a guy down so he can't get up. If necessary, not ever. He appraised her for a moment longer.
I'm a convicted felon. I'm not legally allowed to teach anything like you're talking about. So it would have to be kept strictly confidential.
You can't ever let the authorities know where you learned it. Not a problem.
It also means it would need to be private sessions, just you and me, so that no one else would know about it. That's time I can't teach classes. Private lessons like that are going to cost you.
My grandparents used to protect me from the kind of men who hung around my mother's trailer. When they died, they left me a little money. I'm sure they would love nothing more than for some of that money to go toward me learning how to better protect myself. Nate nodded.
If you're sure you're serious, I'll cancel some classes. That time will be for you exclusively. You will be my only student. I'll lock the door. I'll leave some time on both sides of your time here so people won't see you come and go. No one will see you train or see you in here, and no one will know about this.
Perfect.
I'll skip all the forms and traditional instruction. It's basically repetition practice of game-stopping moves.
I'll just teach you what you need to know to escape from the grip of an attacker and cripple him for life if you need to. And, if necessary, to kill him. He smiled to lighten the grim mood. And when you're done with a lesson, you can always go next door and get your nails done. When do I start? Nate shrugged. Right now, if you want. I do. Do I have to change? Are you planning on changing your clothes before someone tries to kill you? For the first time since coming into the place, Angela smiled. No, I guess not. He smiled with her. She liked his smile.
Well, all right then.
How do we start?
First, I want you to listen to me. Going over that line with the clear intent to kill is not something that most people can do. Even seriously hurting someone is something a lot of people aren't willing to do. You have to realize that the things I'm going to teach you can seriously mess someone up. Some of these moves can kill. Most people, when it comes right down to it, can't bring themselves to kill. These moves can be just as deadly as using your knife on someone. Dead is dead. I want you to think about it. Could you actually stab someone if you had to?
Angela almost laughed, but she didn't. If someone comes at me to kill me, then they are going to get what they deserve. I don't have a problem with that. So how do we begin? Nate's arms were folded across his chest. He let them slip to his sides.
A guy is almost always going to be bigger and stronger than you. You're not going to be able to overpower a guy like that with strength, but you can overpower them with technique.
Okay? How?
Your objective is to disorient, disable, destroy. That requires intent, aggression, momentum.
Now he was talking her language. Angela was quite familiar with disorient, disable, destroy. She'd had plenty of practice at that. She was beginning to feel good about her decision to come to Nate. Show me. Nate reached out and gripped her wrist.
Let's say a guy grabs you like this.
Angela nodded.
That was how one of them grabbed me. Okay. You must first get out of his hold on you. I'm going to show you how to do that by converting his hold to a position where you can break his wrist. Unless the guy is on PCP or something, like the guy I killed, pain is your best tool.
I can't argue with that. He let go of her wrist and looked up to her eyes.
We're going to start by focusing now on how to break the bones in a person's wrist. That takes the fight right out of them and immediately puts you in control. But the sound of breaking bone is revolting. You can't afford to hold back. You need to do these moves with the conscious intent of breaking bones. Are you squeamish?
If he only knew. I'll try not to puke. Angela lifted her arm out toward him again. Show me. She was already feeling good about this. It felt kind of like when her grandfather started teaching her how to shoot. 33. Raphael sat quietly as the cab of the truck rattled and rocked in concert with the idling engine. He'd been in the commercial vehicle line at the border checkpoint for a little over 3 hours. That was about what it normally took to cross into the United States from Mexico at the Oeste Mesa border checkpoint. He idly scanned the details of the crisscrossed girder elements under the catwalk connecting all the booths just ahead. He was close. It wouldn't be long. When the truck ahead of him moved up a space, he released the air brake and put his truck into gear to inch ahead. The cab sprang up and down a little as his rig lugged into the load he was pulling and began moving forward. Once the gap was closed, he set the brake and put the transmission in neutral, letting the diesel engine idle again. The sprawling facility at the Oeste Mesa border crossing was crowded with lines of trucks of every kind.
The vehicles were backed up for miles behind the broad delta of lanes spreading out for the booths, staffed with border agents. Any suspicious trucks or trucks the agents wanted to inspect as a precaution, or even random trucks, were guided to the commercial vehicle enforcement facility down a short side road beyond the booths. There, they would receive more intensive scrutiny. Raphael had been through that extra facility twice. Of course, nothing had ever been found on those practice runs. If they only knew what he was carrying this trip, the place would not be at all so calm with the monotony of a routine day. Raphael rested his arm out the open window as he looked out over the massive numbers of trucks waiting in lines. In the big rearview mirrors, he could see hundreds of trucks waiting in the sweltering sun for their turn to cross over into California. Farther back, vendors had tried to sell him everything from ice cream to food cooked on small carts to puppies to Christian religious goods on tall displays the vendors wheeled in wagons among the waiting trucks. There were no Islamic religious goods for sale. This was the land of the non-believers. For now. He gripped the wheel tighter in anger at being among so many Christians. Someday, all non-believers would be slain, and the world would be united under Islamic rule and Sharia law. He watched border agents in dark uniforms up ahead, going about their work of checking loads, looking over, under, around, and inside vehicles for drugs and other contraband. They also inspected the trucks for safety violations and looked through paperwork. Infidels. Years of surveillance and research had finally brought them to choose the Oeste Mesa facility. Part of the reason behind that decision was that it was a large commercial border crossing into Southern California. California was a sanctuary state. When advance team members had been caught after crossing into California, they had been routinely released to go on their way. Although, even in Texas, it wasn't much of a problem if you were determined to get into the States, you spoke only Spanish and you looked Hispanic. The Americans expected to see Mexicans coming into the United States, both legally and illegally. Raphael and his team worked very hard on every detail to make sure the Americans saw what they expected to see. Just some more Mexicans. That was the reasoning behind the entire team having been raised from very early childhood, speaking Spanish almost exclusively. While some of them spoke Farsi and English, most spoke only Spanish. That was central to their mission. Perfect language, proper hair, appropriate clothes, and they melted right into the teeming masses from south of the border. Even though they were Iranian, they were easily taken for Mexican as long as all the details fit. No one had any reason to take a second look at them. After almost 3 decades, being raised solely for this mission, it seemed surreal for the final phase to be underway. Raphael and the rest of the team had spent the last month working as drivers taking cheap office furniture from a factory in Mexico to a warehouse distribution point in San Diego. The factory was owned through a series of Iranian shell companies. Their jobs, like all the other details of their mission, had been prearranged. Those jobs as truck crews had given Raphael and his team the opportunity to run through practice missions dozens of times as they took loads across the border, all the while checking on how everything worked. They even got to recognize some of the border staff by name. All those trips gave them the opportunity to refine their timing, which was critical. Everyone on the team knew exactly where to be and when. In such a complex mission, it was critical that they get it right. Those practice runs with furniture loads also gave Raphael and his team ample time to assess the methods of the customs and border agents, as well as the way the California Highway Patrol worked. Sitting in line for hours allowed him to closely study the surveillance and detection equipment, and to take note of the numbers and placement of personnel, booths, computer monitors, cameras, the X-ray machines that scanned every load, and most importantly,
the neutron and gamma detectors. Until today, they'd never had anything to detect. Today, his truck had no office furniture. Today, the real mission began. When the truck ahead inched forward, Raphael put his truck in gear and started slowly rolling forward to take up the gap. Cassiel, in the passenger seat, stuck his head out the window, checking ahead, trying to have a look around the truck they were following. He had an AK-47 resting across his lap, as did Raphael. Both men had long banana magazines taped together in opposite directions so that when one ran empty, they could be turned around to use the second fully loaded magazine. It had been Cassiel's idea to carry the guns, not Raphael's. They had never dared to carry weapons in the past, of course, but today it was the real thing, so Cassiel had insisted they carry the guns. The mission had been planned for years in every detail. If anything went wrong, decades of work would be for nothing. If that happened, a couple of AK-47s would not save the operation. A lot of people had spent an enormous amount of time on planning to make sure nothing would go wrong. They'd run through every scenario. There were hundreds of people involved in the operation. Everyone from workers in the enrichment facility in the ancient city of Qom, running the thousands of centrifuges, to the brave reactor crews, to the software engineers, to their allies in North Korea and Pakistan who helped provide the technical expertise they needed. They even had computer operations personnel embedded in Russia. But Cassiel wanted to bring along a fucking gun, as if that could bring down America. While not tall, the man was thick-boned and powerfully built. His head looked like it had been carved from a block of stone. Deep wrinkles and creases gave the impression that his head had been pressed into a cube shape. It almost looked like he had no neck, as if his head had been placed directly on his shoulders. At least his complexion and close-cropped black hair and beard made it easy enough for him to pass as Mexican. From what Raphael knew about him, the man was skilled with every kind of weapon. Even if you saw him without a weapon, he was a man who looked dangerous. People tended to look away and become busy with their own business when Cassiel looked in their direction. Cassiel was, of course, not an original member of their team. He spoke fluent Spanish, among several other languages, including English, so that, at least, helped him fit in. The members of Raphael's team had grown up together since childhood. They were all like brothers. Their having lived together, schooled together, trained together, and prayed together in such a closed group since childhood made infiltration by informants or spies impossible. There was simply no way for an outsider to get into their midst, and no way for any of the team members to talk with an outsider. That was one of the foundational principles for making this portion of the attack undetectable beforehand. While they all spoke Spanish and some English, most of them didn't speak Farsi. Raphael and several of his team spoke Farsi fluently so that they could communicate and coordinate with commanders. It was also necessary for much of the technical training that they'd needed. This was a mission they had been practicing and training for their entire lives. Cassiel, though, had not been part of that. Raphael did not like having such a stranger along on the mission. As far as Raphael was concerned, he might be a gifted assassin, but he was not one of them, and so he did not belong with them. Hassan had told Raphael that Cassiel had been saved from execution because he was such an expert at lethal skills. Hassan had been impressed with how quickly and efficiently Cassiel had killed the Israeli snake with strange vision that could recognize men who were killers. That would allow the men they would send in to kill Israelis and tourists to be successful without being detected the way Wahib had been. The assassination of the man responsible for Wahib's capture only added to Hassan's apparent awe of Cassiel's kill history. Hassan thought that a man of his ability was invaluable. In return for being allowed to live, Cassiel had been assigned to go on the mission with Raphael's team to help them in any way he could. Hassan might have considered him valuable, but Raphael considered him nothing more than hired muscle. Cassiel didn't talk much, although he did follow Raphael's orders. He knew the consequences if he didn't. He seemed perpetually in a sour mood. It probably grated on Cassiel's nature to be indentured to his Iranian masters. Raphael wondered how dedicated he was to their mission. He wondered if the man was prepared to die, as were the rest of them. Somehow, Raphael didn't think so. Some of them, in fact, were going to die this very day. Raphael was a bit disturbed that some of his lifelong brothers were going to give their lives to their cause this day, but Allah would richly reward them for their martyrdom. One of the phones beeped. It was Javier, one of those who was to become a martyr this day. The message asked how close Raphael was to the gamma detector. Raphael told him he was several trucks back. Javier said that he was in the perfect place, then. Raphael could see Esteban's truck, so he knew that he too was in position and ready for the go command. Raphael put the phone back in the tray with the others, each with a piece of tape on the back with a name or a function. Raphael smiled at the collection of iPhones. Apple was a valuable, unwitting partner, providing the very best encryption, which made successful attacks with high death tolls possible. They even refused to give the FBI and other intelligence agencies any help stopping or identifying terrorists. The team also used a messaging app that had end-to-end encryption, which prevented even the technicians who developed it from reading messages. No Western spy agency would be able to know anything they communicated. It was amazing that here they were, at a high-security checkpoint, and they could communicate without fear of being detected, because American companies provided the means and protected their secrecy. None of the border agents running around all over the place and checking everything for the slightest hint of a problem had any idea of what was about to happen. Any idea that they were about to die, and they could not intercept any of the messages coordinating it all. Raphael thought that Silicon Valley was probably the only place in the world completely safe from an attack, because it provided the tools that were so necessary for killing as many Americans, Jews, and other infidels as possible. No jihadist would harm such a valuable resource, the people and companies that made the secrecy and security of jihadist operations possible. The truck ahead moved up to the neutron and gamma detector. Raphael picked up the phone in his lap. 34. Raphael pressed the send button of the message to the team overseeing the operation back in Iran. It was a single, simple word. Now. He watched and waited. A moment later, he saw the computer screens in the string of booths go dark. Border agents leaned closer, peering at monitors, then looked around at the rest of their equipment, looking for the cause of the problem. Some of them typed in commands on their keyboards, trying to bring them back to life. Others checked connections, all to no avail. There was nothing for them to find, and nothing they could fix. On the command from Raphael, hackers had initiated preloaded routines to shut down every piece of electronic equipment at every border crossing with Mexico and Canada. Shutting them all down prevented the authorities from realizing there was an attack at any one specific spot. They might assume that the hack of the border crossings was in and of itself the attack. Every part of the attack was designed to keep them from knowing what was eventually to come. It wasn't just the computers that went dead. All the handheld devices they depended on for everything from logging data to taking readings also went dead. Every reader and scanner linked to their system went dead. The computers that ran the X-ray scanners, neutron detectors, and gamma detectors, and logged the data also went dead. The electricity to the entire facility simultaneously went down. The lighted message boards with lane numbers and other information that changed throughout the day went dark. Every bit of equipment went quiet. Raphael smiled as he watched the confused faces of the border agents. Some leaned out of their booths to ask others if their systems were down as well, or if it was only them. They yelled their frustration from one booth to another. Other people were busy attempting to reboot systems to try to fix the problem. Of course, their systems would not reboot. The roving agents who checked paperwork and looked over equipment and loads returned to the booths to see why their handheld devices weren't working. Many of the agents in the booths picked up phones to call in, but the landline phone systems that connected them to the operations center had gone dead as well. Finding the phones not working, they turned to their cell phones, but those phones weren't linked directly into the centers, so it would take them time to get through to the right individuals, and those people would be swamped with calls not only from this border crossing, but from them all. To make matters worse, their computer screens showed only ransom demands. Those ransom demands were, of course, fake, but it would be quite a while, possibly days, before they came to realize that it wasn't really ransomware. Even if the people Raphael was watching did get through on their cell phones, there was nothing the center would be able to do. It would take time to uncover the hack and then to regain control of their systems. And their time had just run out. Raphael picked up the phone with Javier's name written on the tape on the back. It was time to begin their part of the mission. Javier would be waiting for his encrypted orders. Raphael set the message that said, "Go with God." Raphael tilted his head back to look between the lines of waiting trucks. Javier was in the lane on the far end of the facility. Although the border checkpoint was relatively level, it was somewhat higher at that far end. Javier was driving a regular tractor trailer, but hidden inside his ordinary-looking trailer, he carried a 2,000-gallon steel tank filled with gasoline. The trailer had hatches below valves on the tank. Once he received word from Raphael, Javier hit a switch that dropped the three hatches in the floor of the truck. When those hatches sprang open, they automatically opened the gravity valves on the tank above. Gasoline poured out of three wide-opened valves and began spreading across the pavement as it ran downhill under all the waiting trucks. Border Patrol agents smelled the gasoline and began coming out of their booths to look for the source. Raphael picked up the phone with Esteban's name. He could see Esteban out of his truck, standing near the rear of his trailer. Many of the other drivers had emerged from their trucks as well, because of the apparent failure of the electricity and computers, so none of the security officers thought anything of Esteban being out of his truck. At least half a dozen officers finally converged on the truck spewing gasoline. At first, they ran around the truck looking for the source of all the gasoline. When they saw the open gravity feed valves, they drew guns and pointed them up at Javier in the cab of his truck. Raphael pressed send for the message to Esteban. "Go with God." Esteban, only two lanes over from Raphael's truck, had been waiting for the order. He glanced briefly at the message for confirmation, then deliberately dropped the phone in the river of gasoline. He put a foot up on the rear crash bar that kept cars from submarining under the back end of the truck in the event of an accident, and hoisted himself up. He quickly pulled open the latch and then lifted the roll-up door. Lining the sides of the trailer's interior were over 100 cages. Esteban pulled the handle on a steel cable that sequentially unlatched all those doors. The doors of the cages had springs, so once the latches were released, they sprang open, one after another. Over 100 dogs, most pit bulls, bolted from their cages and spilled out of the back end of the truck. All the dogs had been bred and raised in Mexico to be vicious. They had all been trained for one thing, to attack anyone in a border agent or highway patrol officer uniform. They had been trained to ignore gunfire and loud explosions. All the dogs were also wearing bomb vests packed with high explosives, ball bearings, screws, and nails. Some of the dogs began fighting each other, but most single-mindedly charged toward border agents and highway patrol officers. The dogs storming around all the standing trucks at the border checkpoint created confusion and disarray. Tactics used in the training of border agents and police for gaining control of a situation suddenly became worthless. While prepared for an assault by men, they were not prepared for an attack by dozens of vicious dogs. Some of the dogs raced in and latched onto a leg with their powerful jaws. The dogs would never release the leg they had in their jaws, so the men now had a heavy dog anchoring them. Men drew guns and shot the dogs clamped on their leg, but the damage had already been done. Other dogs clamped onto arms held up defensively. Once they had that arm in their teeth, they shook it for all they were worth. The stocky dogs had powerful neck muscles, and when they shook their prey, it tore muscle from bone. Other dogs, running at full speed, leaped up at the men, knocking the wind from them as they knocked them down. Once they had their prey on the ground, they went for the throat or face. There was no effective way to physically fight them off. Only guns could stop them. One dog leaped onto and grabbed a female officer by her breast. As she toppled back with the dog on top of her, she drew her gun and shot it, only to have another dog race in and clamp her face in his powerful jaws. When he shook her head, it tore neck muscles and ripped flesh from her face. People everywhere, both agents and truck drivers who had gotten out of their trucks, screamed in terror or pain. Some of the drivers who had been waiting at booths saw the erupting chaos, put their trucks in gear, and took off to escape before they were caught up in the attack. Men in other trucks leaped out and ran, leaving their trucks blocking the lane between booths. While some dogs attacked the same man, most of the angry animals raced throughout the facility, looking for people in uniforms to attack. They spread out as they ran, going after any uniformed officer they saw. It only took seconds for guns to be drawn. Officers everywhere began shooting at the dogs. A few took down a dog, but many shots missed the racing animals as they zigzagged through all the trucks and people. The shooting diverted their attention from the true danger. As officers tried to shoot the dogs, the timers on the vests the dogs were wearing ran out, and the bombs exploded. Everywhere throughout the entire facility, the dogs' bomb vests started going off. It didn't matter if a dog had been shot dead. The vests had already been armed, and they exploded by their internal timer, sending shrapnel streaking out in every direction. People close enough but not directly taken down by the explosion were shredded by the ball bearings and nails. People farther away were hit with shrapnel and went down. Others were wounded but still able to run. They did their best to stop the bleeding of injuries as they ran. Many ran directly into another explosion where they were blown limb from limb. While some detonators went off almost immediately after the attack started and created mass confusion, others had delays of anywhere from 10 to 60 seconds, adding to the confusion. As bombs were going off, the dogs left alive continued their attack until their bomb vests, in turn, exploded. Those explosions spread the pandemonium and death out to those who had not been in the original danger zone. Several of the officers around Javier's truck turned to shoot at the dogs that raced in toward them. Others held their weapons pointed up at Javier, since he was the driver of the truck dumping thousands of gallons of gasoline all over the ground. They yelled at him to get out of the truck, or they would shoot. Javier was holding a dead man's switch. Rafael knew that Javier yelled, "Allahu Akbar!" back at them. They grasped the meaning and immediately began retreating, even as they opened fire. A few seconds later, Javier's truck exploded with a ground-shaking thud. The men in close
climbing up to open the driver's door to the truck, were vaporized when the massive bomb in the sleeper compartment of his truck cab detonated. The huge explosion sent debris flying in every direction. The expanding shockwave from the explosion knocked people from their feet. It rocked all the trucks trapped at the checkpoint. Raphael's truck rocked in turn as the blast wave raced past. The catwalk above the booths came apart, and parts of it blew high into the air. Half of the booths and personnel in them were blown to pieces, adding to the flaming debris flying through the air. The big axle and tandem wheels off a truck sailed out over the row of booths and into California. A massive ball of red flame laced with orange and yellow tendrils expanded from the initial explosion. Raphael squinted at the bright blast. Fire boiled over the surrounding trucks. Black smoke swelled up into the air. Almost simultaneously, the gasoline vapor from all the fuel that had poured out across the area caught fire with a chest-pounding thump, igniting the gasoline that had poured across the ground. Trucks to the side couldn't even attempt to escape by driving around, because they were hemmed in by natural terrain that rose up in most of the area around the checkpoint. Where there wasn't a natural obstruction, massive cement barriers had been placed to prevent anyone from trying to drive around the checkpoints to get into the United States. Those barriers now created a tightly confined trap that was rapidly becoming a killing field. All the while, more of the vests on the dogs kept exploding in a deadly drumbeat, creating a continual cacophony of ear-splitting booms. The air everywhere was filled with shrapnel. Men still standing went down. With the dogs released, Esteban started into his truck to detonate the bomb in the front of his trailer. He only made it 2 steps before he was brought down by a hail of bullets from a few of the California Highway Patrol officers still alive. Raphael had been expecting it. They had planned and trained for it. He picked up another waiting phone and immediately pressed the send button. As he did so, he ducked. Almost instantly, Esteban's truck blew apart in another massive explosion, bigger than the first. But this one was to a large degree a shaped charge meant to expend most of its energy to the right side. The blast blew apart the truck beside it and the one beside that one that had been sitting at the gamma ray detector in front of Raphael's truck. Flaming debris ripped down poles and power lines. The metal siding off one of the trucks spiraled up into the air. A massive chunk of metal hit the hood of Raphael's truck with a bang and bounced over the cab. The air was filled with smoke trails left by burning, unrecognizable bits of wreckage sailing through the air. Trucks that were trapped and unable to move were engulfed in flames from the burning gasoline that had spread under them. Blazes whooshed to life all throughout the standing vehicles. Men screamed as they were burned alive in the cabs of their trucks. Others tried to escape by running through the rivers of burning gasoline. As they ran, their shoes and then their pants ignited. Flames roared up to engulf their shirts and then their hair. Screams came from faces inside swirling columns of fire. Many of those running figures succumbed to the smoke or breathed in the flames and collapsed in the inferno. People ran in every direction, trying to skirt flaming trucks and flying debris, trying to find safety. There was none. Acrid, thick black smoke rolled across the scene, obscuring the lines of trucks. Orange flame licked out from the wall of inky smoke. Throughout it all, the bomb vests on the dogs with delayed fuses continued to explode. Explosions shocked the air. If ever there was a scene of hell, this was it. Trucks at the front up near the booths that were not caught up in the fire or destroyed by the explosions sped away to escape the mayhem. Most of the border agents were dead. The few that weren't were tending their own wounds or trying to find a way to fight back. They were not worried about trucks that began fleeing in a panic from the death and destruction. As they picked up speed going for the few openings in the debris and wreckage, they collided with other trucks also trying to escape. Other drivers tried to maneuver between the damaged vehicles or around crippled trucks, driving over smoldering bodies and leveled border check booths. The explosions from the dogs' bomb vests finally trailed off. Raphael checked his watch to make sure the timers had all run out. He didn't want to get caught by an explosion from a dog running from the scene. The dogs were trained to be unafraid of gunfire and explosions, but in some, their natural instincts took over, and they were panicking to get away from the flames. He didn't see any of them still around the immediate area. Finally, the time had arrived. Raphael jammed his truck into gear and released the brake. With the truck in front that had been blocking his way at the neutron and gamma detectors now mostly obliterated, Raphael began gathering speed and plowing aside torn pieces of the trailer. An axle with tandem wheels still attached spun like a top as it was knocked off to the side. Large sheets of metal siding toppled as he crashed through remaining pieces of the truck beds. All around, trucks burned and people screamed, some in pain and some for help. Some of the other drivers and the border agents tried to rescue people trapped in burning trucks. Fuel tanks continued to rupture and poured diesel fuel on the fire, creating thick clouds of black smoke. Even though he had rolled up the window, Raphael could feel the withering heat radiating from the fires. As he gathered speed, he rammed into what was left of one of the truck cabs that had been in line ahead of him. The shell of the body and tires had been mostly blown away in the explosion. He used his truck to push it, trying to get it out of the way. Instead of being pushed aside, it rotated sideways ahead of Raphael's grill, sliding sideways on bare rims in front of his truck. With no bodywork left, the dead driver could be seen hanging in his seatbelt, his left arm blown off from the explosion. Raphael kept pushing the skeleton of the truck cab until they were past the booth area. Once clear, he spun the wheel to turn his truck to push the smoldering wreck of a truck cab off to the side. Throughout the entire attack and aftermath, Casiel had sat quietly watching. He said nothing and took no action. Fortunately, he didn't attempt to lift his gun to shoot out the window at the enemy when he had a chance. Raphael had told him beforehand that their job was to play the part of innocent victims caught in a terrorist attack. The last thing they needed was to have anyone who was still alive, or any of the officers rushing to the scene from nearby areas, see someone shooting an AK-47 out of the passenger window of an escaping truck. That would instantly tip them off that Raphael's truck was part of the attack. It would ruin years of planning. The plan was for Raphael to look like one of the many innocent trucks frantically fleeing the scene of death and destruction. There were trucks that, once past the carnage, pulled over. Drivers jumped out to render assistance to the scores of injured. But many more trucks simply fled in a panic, too horrified by the carnage to want to stay. Raphael wanted to be in among those innocent people fleeing the scene. He wanted to look like any other Mexican truck driver, racing away for fear of his own life. 35. As they drove north, away from the carnage at the Oesta Mesa border crossing, flames leaped up from the carcasses of dozens of trucks burning in the distance behind them. Thousands of burning embers floated through the air. An ever-growing mass of black smoke rose into the air until the higher altitude winds tore the top off the sinister column in a long, dark smudge against the bright blue sky. Emergency vehicles on the other side of the divided highway raced south toward the scene. Raphael could see flashing lights converging from roads to either side. It looked like every police car in Southern California was streaming toward the border crossing, creating a river of flashing lights. They were too late. They always were. They only showed up after an attack. Ambulances in ever-increasing numbers sped toward the massacre. They would not be able to save many lives. They would have to search through piles of burned bodies to find anyone still alive. There would be some they could help, but they would waste their time taking the large numbers of gravely injured to hospitals, only to have them die on the journey, or over the next few days, while one still undiscovered expired. Raphael smiled to himself. The relatives of all the infidel dead would weep this night, and for many more, they would think it was over. They would think this was one of the biggest terrorist attacks ever. They would have no idea that this was not even the real event. The time was rapidly approaching for all the non-believers to die. Several times Raphael had to pull his truck over onto the shoulder for police cars racing down the wrong side of the highway in their urgency to get around traffic and to the scene. But every time, once they had passed, Raphael quickly pulled back out and kept going. He needed to be lost in the mass confusion to escape the scene. Cars and trucks had pulled over all along the highway. People stood beside their vehicles, a hand shielding their eyes from the late afternoon sun as they stared southwest to the fire and smoke. None of them could possibly imagine what had just taken place. They would all be following the news for days and weeks to come as they gossiped about what they had seen. Other people in cars, SUVs, and pickups continued heading south, following the emergency vehicles, to see for themselves what was happening at the Oeste Mesa border crossing. The determined, ghoulish sightseers would slip through the confused police lines or go around overland to take countless photos and videos of the wreckage, the fires, and the smoldering bodies. They would rush breathlessly to post them on the internet. Those photos and videos would also find their way to all the Islamic Jihadi websites. Many would wrongly take credit for the attack and promise more to come. Those images would spread across social media, and in a matter of hours, people all over the country, all over the world, would be able to see the results of the attack. Everyone would express shock at the number of dead. People all over America would get a sobering taste of how weak they really were, how blind, how foolish. What no one realized at the moment, though, was that there were simultaneous attacks being carried out all over the United States, and even in a few countries overseas. Bodies would be left after every kind of attack, from stabbings at malls, to trucks used to run over pedestrians, to bombs at airport checkpoints, to poison gas attacks in three different subways. Cities from Seattle to Las Vegas to Chicago to Miami to New York would all be caught up in the grip of terror. Everyone would remember this date. At least for now. Everyone would think that this day that cities burned and victims bled and died was the big event, the biggest strike ever against the great Satan. Even as the dust settled, there would be demands for investigations to find out where so much had gone wrong. There would be hand-wringing. Every intelligence agency would blame a lack of adequate funding. But it would all be about what had happened, not about what was going to happen. Everyone was blind to that. America itself had helped Raphael and his team keep the secret of what they planned. Raphael had used the tools, both the physical tools and the political tools, that America had so willingly provided to get him, his team, and their supplies into the country. Authorities across the country would be kept investigating the attacks and trying to identify those involved. They would be focused on peeling back layers and networks. They very likely would eventually trace information on everyone involved. They would come to know the names of those who were captured or killed, or who had escaped and were being hunted, and the names of their organizations. It would be all over the news. They would collect all the surveillance data of conversations from people involved in those attacks. They would scour all the social media postings of everyone involved. As always, it was after the fact and too late to make a difference. There would be endless reporting about how these people had somehow escaped scrutiny, or had been on watch lists but not arrested, or had slipped into the country on visas or as refugees and no one had done anything about it. They would get mountains of intelligence from informants. They would analyze the chatter and discover the scope of it all. They would also find pieces of the bodies of Javier and Esteban, but it would do them no good, because they wouldn't be able to identify the charred remains or link them to any group. Unlike all the other groups involved in all the other attacks, Rafael and his group were unknown to any intelligence agency. Over the decades of their training, they had never interacted with any terrorist group or movement. They were ghosts. Many of the people who were also part of that ghost group and who had helped give logistic support to the mission were long since on their way out of the country. They would vanish in the wind. That kept Rafael and his in-country team, unlike everyone else in the many attacks, not only undetected, but completely unknown. He was the ghost who had slipped through the chaos, unknown, undetected. All the other jihadist groups who carried out the other attacks around America also believed this was the big attack. Not even they knew the truth. That secrecy was necessary to prevent anyone involved with the other attacks, if captured, from disclosing anything about Rafael's group. They had never even heard rumors of Rafael and his group. They couldn't reveal what they didn't know. Rafael kept his speed in check to match the other trucks leaving the scene. He didn't want to give nervous, trigger-happy police officers any excuse to notice him or stop him for questioning. With all the traffic they were mingling into, the risk of discovery was continually melting away. The big worry was that they would be stopped to have their load inspected. It would be a very bad thing if any of the authorities looked in the trailer he was hauling. That was the whole reason behind the destruction at the Oeste Mesa border crossing. There they had X-ray equipment, neutron detectors, gamma-ray detectors, as well as very savvy border agents. Rafael and his group had just nullified all of those safety measures and the entire system behind them. Although it was highly unlikely anymore that they would be stopped, it was always possible that Casiel could handle them. But it was also much more possible that he couldn't. Casiel was an assassin, a killer, to be sure, but he was not a commando or soldier. It wasn't his specialty. If the police started shooting, it took only one bullet for Rafael to be killed or disabled. That would end their entire mission. They had to rely on their years of careful planning, not on Casiel. As far as Rafael was concerned, Casiel was just excess baggage he had to drag along. Rafael took the first exit to the westbound connector into San Diego. Before long, they merged into masses of heavy late-day traffic. In a little over an hour, they reached the industrial area where the rest of the team would be waiting, and they could at last ditch the truck that had been through the border crossing. Rafael phoned Fernando as they turned off the main road into the maze of small office parks and warehouses. Streets lined with palm trees reminded him a little of home. As he pulled up to the building they owned through a shell company, the big overhead door rolled open. Rafael drove the truck right inside and parked at the far end of the building. He sat for a moment after he shut down the engine, relieved to at last be hidden in a safe place. Forklifts were standing by to begin transferring the material they were carrying to the smaller cargo van. Behind the important materials they would load into the van, they would place some household furniture to hide what they were carrying on the off chance a police officer opened the rear door. From a professional truck driver, Rafael was now to become a new immigrant with a used van, driving cross-country with a friend and their furniture to settle in another state. The other members of the team would be in cars escorting them in a loose convoy. Alejandro, Rafael's second in command, would ride in a car that would always be right behind him. The other team members would take a variety of other vehicles. No one would be able to tell, but it would be a convoy that would always protect the cargo van Rafael was driving. Rafael had told Casiel that he was to ride in the van with him. Rafael thought it best if he kept an eye on the man. Members of